Tonight, we want to continue our discussion of the serious nature of the thing called sin. As we discussed this morning, after all of God's creative work, he said in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31 that everything that he had created was very good. And then when we get to the events of chapter number 3, everything changes. And from that moment on until this moment, until the end of time, things will never be the same again. And the reason that they will never be the same is because of this little three-letter word called sin. And this morning we concluded in looking at some safeguards that God gives us in order that we might not be deceived and be misled by Satan, in order that we would participate and we would commit sin. And so we want to continue tonight by looking at the beginning of sin and looking at the allurement of sin. And this is a lesson that's going to carry on for a couple more lessons, because we need to understand the nature of sin, how it works, and how it gets into our lives, and what it can do to us, and what is the remedy to make sure that we can protect ourselves from this terrible onslaught of mankind. So we want to continue talking about Satan's allurement tonight. We want to begin by looking at 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse number 3. Now, we mentioned this passage briefly this morning, but again, this is talking about the tactics of Satan. And in this statement it says, "But I fear lest somehow, as a serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ." You know, it's always amazed me talking to people about the Bible, talking to them about Christianity, and how they tell me how complicated it is and how difficult it is to understand. That is an excuse. The Bible is not complicated. It is not difficult to understand. As a matter of fact, it is quite simple what God asked for, and it is quite understandable to know what you need to do in order to please him. Notice in this verse, it says that we've been deceived. Eve was deceived, and men are deceived by the craftiness of your mind, that they can be corrupted, that the simplicity of Christ is false. But it is not false. It is true. And we discussed this morning in great detail deception. That is trying to make something appear one thing when it is really something else. And this is Satan's greatest, this is his greatest masterpiece. He creates sin as being meaningless, as being not harmful, not destructive, not condemning, and that sin is really not as bad as God says it is. And it is not something that's going to really destroy you, and practicing it a little really doesn't hurt you. That is his greatest deception, in trying to make sin what it is and what it is not. He tries to change the makeup. He tries to change what it appears like. But his greatest weapon is he tries to convince men that it cannot kill them spiritually. But we looked at many passages this morning that clearly teach that sin has a destructive capability. Notice, remember, we talked about Isaiah 59. Sin separates a man from God. We talked about Romans chapter 6 that tells us that the wages of sin is death. And so there is a destructive thing about sin. There is a destructive clause about sin. And there is something dangerous about it. And there is something that we need to be on alert about. And we need not to be deceived and not to be misled that a little bit of sin is okay. And so, as Eve was deceived, that is exactly how Satan works today. He tries to deceive us by making it appear that sin is not as bad as we think it is. Now, you remember in Genesis chapter 3, the question was asked. God's word was questioned. Remember what the serpent said? He said, "Has God said, thou shalt not eat of every tree that is in the garden?" Did God really say that? In other words, did God really mean that? You know, I know he said it, but is that what he really meant? You know, he questioned God's word. And this is one of the things that Satan is always doing. He's really questioning whether God means what he says. Whether or not what God says is indeed what he means. But I want to suggest to you tonight that God, he knows exactly what he's saying. That he knows exactly what he means. And he says it in an understandable way that man can understand. And you remember this morning, we quoted Eve's answer. She answered the serpent verbatim into what God had told her and Adam. She gave the direct answer that God gave them in Genesis 2, 16 and 17. And so what that tells me is that God can communicate his will to man in an understandable way that he can understand, that he can comprehend, and that he has the ability to obey it. But Satan tries to convince him that God, well, he didn't exactly mean what you thought he meant. He really meant something different. Now, I want to show you tonight that that's exactly how the devil still works. And he works in many different ways. Where Satan questions God today? How does Satan question God today? Is he still trying to question whether or not God means what he says? Does he still use this tactic today? And I want to tell you that not only does he, but he's intensified it. And I'm going to give you some examples how. Has God indeed said evil company corrupts good habits? Did God really say that? Is that what God really meant? In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, the writer says, evil company corrupts good habits. Well, is that what God meant? Is that a truth? Do evil companions corrupt, give us bad habits? Do they corrupt our morals? Can they lead us in a way that's contrary to God's will? Ladies and gentlemen, you could spend your whole life teaching your children, instructing them, giving them a good foundation to build up on, and another person in their life, a friend, a spouse, an acquaintance at work, has the ability to destroy every good thing that you tried to instill in your children, and we try to instill in others. And if you put yourself around people who will corrupt your mind, it will lead you astray. Now I'm going to ask you a simple question. Will the people in the world help you live closer to God, or will other people trying to achieve the same thing you are help you live closer to God? Is the world going to commend you when you follow God's will, when you stand against the crowd, when you do things that are not very popular, when you take positions that are not popular with the mainstream way of thinking? Are they going to commend you for that? Are they going to respect you for that? Now, some people will. There are some people, even though they won't participate, they will respect your belief and your diligence and to do what God says. But for generally speaking, the world is not going to help you live for God. And if you, and let me tell you, I've told you this before, but I want to remind you of something. It has been my experience in over 30 years of preaching. People that have fallen away and have left the faith have one common thread in their life. They did not surround themselves with people that could have helped them prevent from falling away. Their friends and their acquaintances were not members of the church. They were people in the world. Now, do not misunderstand me. You can have friends in the world. That's not a sin. And you can have acquaintances. And we work with people who are not Christian. That's not sinful. But when you constantly put yourself in the company of people who are living contrary to God, who have no religious conviction, who have no determination to live for God, and you put yourself and you align yourself with those kind of people around you, over time, they will wear you down. They will wear you down. And what happens is we become vulnerable and we become weak and we don't even realize it. You see, that's why the Bible tells us that we're a family. And you know what? Your physical family, that's something that's very precious to us. That's something that means a lot to us. And you know, there's not too many people or things that can get between me and my family. my children, my grandchildren. Those are things that are very precious to me. Those are things that I have great value to me. And it would be very difficult for somebody to drive a wedge between them and me. But you know what? That's exactly what God's trying to do. Satan is trying to do with God's people. He's trying to drive a wedge between God's people and Satan. And how he does that is he wants you to get as close to sin that it can rub off on you. That it can influence you to do the wrong thing. That's one of his tactics. And he does that by telling you, no, you go to church on Sunday, you go to Bible study on Wednesday, you know, you're around Christians enough, and you know, it doesn't hurt you to have friends in the world, and it doesn't hurt you to miss once in a while, and it doesn't hurt you to do certain things that maybe you don't, that you think you shouldn't do, but it really doesn't matter, it really doesn't hurt you. And all it is a ploy in order to get you to live contrary to God's will. Because when he does that, then he has the ability to lead you further and further and further away from God. Did God really mean that there's danger and evil companions? Is that what he meant? Or did Satan, has he convinced people that God misspoke about that? He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companions of fools will be destroyed. You know what? You put bad people around you, it's going to have an effect. You put people around you that don't love God, don't respect his word, don't have any religious conviction, don't have any parameters on how they live, how they speak, what they think, what they do, and you put yourself in their company continually, and you do it on a regular basis. You know, there's another proverb that says, can a man take fire in his bosom and not get burnt? You know what you're doing, ladies and gentlemen? You're playing with fire. When you put yourself in the devil's backyard, and you play by the devil's rules, and you play with the devil's people, how do you think it's going to not end badly? This is the reason why God warns us about what kind of companions we choose. You know, in the life that I do, in the work that I do, one of the things that I have the privilege and honor of doing is I have the privilege and honor of marrying people. And whenever people come to me and ask me to perform their wedding and perform their wedding ceremony, one of the things that I will not do, and one thing I have never done in my preaching career, that I do not marry people who are not Christians. I do not do that. Now, it's not sinful. Don't get me wrong. It's not sinful. But I think it's dangerous. And here's why I think it's dangerous. I want you to think about this. You know, there's been a lot of debate over the years about Christians marrying non-Christians. And I understand that debate. It's not sinful. But here's my problem. Here's what I want you to think about. There's two things that you will decide to do in your life that are the greatest decisions that you will make, because they have the most powerful effect on your life. Number one is whether or not you obey the gospel. That's an important decision, because that's going to determine whether or not you go to heaven or hell. That's the greatest decision that you have to make. The second is who you marry, because you understand this: you marry somebody because you love them. You marry somebody that you love and you want to spend the rest of your life with. But let me ask you a question. How does it not affect you emotionally, psychologically, and eventually wear you down, or have the ability to wear you down, if you marry someone who's going in the exact opposite spiritual direction that you are? Every day you live, you know if your mate does not make themselves right with God, that they are headed for one place spiritually and you are headed another. You love that person. Does that have an effect on you? Does that have an effect on you? I believe it does have an effect on you if you really love that person. And so what you try to do is you try to set the example. You try to be the influence. But in your mind, and listen, I have a lot of empathy. And I greatly admire people that are in this situation. And I admire what they try to do. And I want to help them. I don't want to make their situation worse. But you know what? I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. A number of years ago when I was in Ohio, I had a paper there that I had for about 12 years. And I decided one issue that I was going to allow the women to write their articles. And I had a special issue that was written by all the articles that were written by women, members of the Lord's Church. There was one of my sisters there who was married to a Roman Catholic. Now, when she married, she was a member of the church, and he was a Roman Catholic. He had been one all of his life. And she thought in her mind that she could enter that relationship and she would not lose her Christianity, that she would remain faithful to God, and she did. But what she didn't think about and what she never comprehended and thought about were her children. Today, all of her children are grown. And while they were growing up, one Sunday they went to the Roman Catholic Church, and the other Sunday they went to the Lord's Church. And they did that all of their lives. Today, none of them are Christians. She wrote this article, and I could not type it without crying. She wrote this article in saying, I made this decision for me, but I didn't think about them. And she blames herself, and she's not to blame, but she blames herself that she didn't think about that. That she didn't ponder that when she entered that relationship. Now, brethren, what I'm telling you is, we need to understand, if we want to go to heaven, you're going to have to make some decisions that's going to be very different than people in the world make. And there's a reason why God says in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 that we should not be entangled in things. An unbeliever has nothing in common with a believer. They don't have anything in common. And so we need to understand that God knows what he's talking about. God has indeed said, withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly. Not only is this difficult for people in the world, this is difficult for people in the Lord's church. That's really not what God meant. He didn't really mean that. That's not what he really said. I know that's what he said, but that's not what he means. Really? In 2 Thessalonians 3:6, here's what God said. But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to tradition that you received of us. Now, we're not going to get into a lesson about withdrawing fellowship, but you know what? That's what God said. That's what God said in his word. Now, did he mean that or did he mean something else? Did he mean there are exceptions to that? Did he mean that we don't really need to do that? You know, that's probably a good thing to do, but you really don't need to do that. That's just like what he told Eve. I know God said you would die, but you won't die. And so we get into this discussion that we should not do this because it's not loving, it's not being kind, it's not doing the right thing. By whose standard? What are we trying to do? You know what's lost in this discussion? Why this is even done. Why is that done? What is the motive behind doing that? As a matter of fact, it's the last step in trying to win a person back to the Lord. But why is it done? It's not done to be ugly. It's not done out of hatred. It's not done because we're trying to judge. It's done in order to make the person wake up spiritually, the condition of their soul, and where they're headed if they don't repent. Now, I want to use as an example tonight, in this particular thing, my father. In 1974, the members of the Lord's Church, we didn't have elders in the little church that I grew up in, and they came to visit my father. He had been out of duty for a number of years. He had been in and out of the church for many years. My dad fought a real battle in staying faithful to the Lord all most of his life that I knew of while I was growing up. But I remember I was about 16 at the time when they came to the house. And I remember sitting there with him, and I remember them talking to him. And I remember exactly what my dad said. He said this. He said, I know why you're here. I know what you have to do. And I know you love me, and I know you would rather me not do the things that I'm doing, but you know what? That's my decision. And I'm not going to play the part of a hypocrite. I'm not going to say that I'm going to live right when I know that I'm not going to live right. You do what you have to do, and I understand what the chances I'm taking, the risk I'm taking, and I understand that you're doing this out of love, but I've determined that I'm not going to do what the Lord wants me to do because I don't want to do that. And so he doesn't. That was over 43 years ago. Nothing's changed. Now, do I believe that those good men drove my dad off? No, I don't believe that. I believe they tried to help him. But you know, in every situation, one thing is not ever taken away. Free will. Men can fight against God. Can they? Can men fight against God? Yes, they can fight against God. Can they fight against God's plans? Yes, they can fight against God's plans. But you know what? That doesn't mean God's plans are wrong. Adam and Eve didn't obey God. That didn't mean that the commandment was bad. That meant their decision was bad. Just like my father's decision was bad. And I pray every day. Every day and every time I see him. To remind him that he made a bad decision. And he needs to change it. And I'll do that till the day he dies or I die. But I'll never blame the church for running him off. He did that himself. He made that decision himself. He's not the victim. I'm the victim. I'm the victim. The church is a victim. Because we paid the price. Has God indeed said a woman is not to teach or have authority over a man, but to be in silence? Is that what God really meant? Today, one of the greatest raging questions in religion is the place, the role of women in the church. I know that's what God said in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And I do not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man, but to be in silence. I know that's what God said, but is that what God really meant? You know, we live in a different society. We live in a different time. We live in the modern era. And we live where there's equality between men and women. And so there's really no distinction. And so, God, you know, that's not relevant today. It doesn't fit the times. It's not in the modern way of thinking. You know what? That's right. It's not in the modern way of thinking. But the question that man needs to ponder is, has God changed his mind about it? Now, it doesn't mean that women are inferior. It doesn't mean they're not knowledgeable. It doesn't mean they're not more spiritual than men. You know, it's been my observation and my experience that some of the most spiritual people in the Lord's church are women in every church I've been a member of. In every church I've been a member of, including this one, there are many women who are very, very spiritual minded and a great source of encouragement in their knowledge and their understanding of God's word. And I appreciate them. But they have a role in those women that are in that position. They respect God's rules and they stay in the role that God gave them. A number of years ago, we were in the Philippines and we were in a question and answer period after some sermons. And there was a lady that came to our seminar that day. And after, she was asking a question about she was asking questions about eldership. And she let it slip while she was talking to Brother Ron in the question and answer that she was a pastorette, that she was a woman preacher. So Ron just asked her, he goes, am I understanding this right? Are you a preacher? She goes, oh yes. I have a congregation. She said where it was at. I forget where it was at. She says, yeah, I've been pastoring that church for about 6 years. She says, Ron says, can I ask you a question? He said, sure. He read her this passage. And then he read her 1 Corinthians 14:34. And she says, you know, I wrestled with those passages for a long time. And I prayed about it. And God told me that don't worry about it. Ron said, did God mean what he said? Did God change his mind about what he said there? You know, she walked out of that place, she was struggling. She was struggling because she had to admit that that's what the passage said. And if she was going to work contrary to that, she would have to believe that God changed his mind about that. But what evidence did she have that God had changed his mind about that? You see, God means what he said. Again, we're talking about roles. We're not talking about inferiority. We're not talking about a woman is a second class. We're not talking about that. We're talking about roles in the worship and the work of the church. That's all we're talking about. We're not talking about whether she's smarter or whether she's brighter or more intelligent. That's not the issue. The issue is the role. Her role is one of submission. And it's not an inferior role. It's just different. Both are needed. The man's role is needed. The woman's role is needed. And anybody that thinks that a woman is not important in the Lord's plan has never read the Bible. Has never read the Bible. Because nothing could be further than the truth. Has God indeed said, do not envy the oppressor? In Proverbs chapter 3, do not envy the oppressor and choose none of his ways. For the perverse person is an abomination to the Lord, but his secret counsel is with the upright. You know what? I do not think in any time or place you have to be very careful not to let hatred creep into your mind when people do things that are contrary. I don't know how many of you have seen it today. They had another thing in Pakistan, where a park was bombed that killed 63 women and children and injured 315. You know, I don't hate those terrorists, but I sure hate what they do. I sure hate what they do, and I hope that we can find a solution that we can remedy the situation. But you know what? We've got to be very careful that we don't hate. We don't have a right to hate anybody. And we should never envy the oppressor. We should pray for them, as Jesus told us in the early parts of Matthew. Has God indeed said that we should not boast about tomorrow? Did God say that? Satan says, he really didn't mean that. Don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow's okay. Proverbs 17:27 verse 1 says, do not boast about tomorrow, for ye do not know what a day may bring forth. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. In James chapter 4, it tells us that our life is but a vapor that appears for a little while. But Satan says, you got plenty of time. Don't rush it. Go out and sow your wild oats. Go out and do what you want to do. Enjoy your life. You're young. You got your whole life ahead of you. Maybe. Maybe not. Do we know what the future holds? We don't know what the future holds. In Luke chapter 12, we remember the man that had such an abundant crop that he didn't know what to do, so he tore down his barns, built bigger barns, put them up, stored his goods, and sat back and took it easy, and says, I'm set for years. And he just began to eat, drink, and be merry because he had all these things laid up for years. You know what the Lord called him in Luke chapter 12, verse 20? Called him a fool. You know why? Was it wrong to lay up for the future? No. Was it wrong to make decisions that would protect your future? No, that wasn't wrong. But what he did is he forgot about God. He forgot that his life is not his own and his life could end it anymore. Remember what God said? He said, tonight thy soul will be required of you, and who will all these things be that you've stored up? What good would they do you then? You see, time is not on the side of us. Our time can run out at any time. The Lord could come back again. We could die. Tragedy could strike us. It can happen at any time. I'm reminded of this all the time. Last December 20th, last year, I was at the halls after services for a holiday get-together. And you look at my phone, and my phone's beeping. And it's my daughter asking me, crying. I knew whatever was coming, I knew was bad. And her father-in-law had fell in the kitchen. You see, they had him in the emergency room. They were about to do emergency surgery on him. 67 years old. I was supposed to be at their home on Thursday, that week. They invited us over for dinner. and we were supposed to be there for dinner. He had an aneurysm and he died, and his life was over. Instantaneously. Every time that happens to me, it reminds me of the brevity of life. It reminds me that I need to be ready. And you know what, ladies and gentlemen, the older I get, the more I understand that the greater part of my life is behind me. That every day I live, I'm one day closer to eternity. Does that scare me? No. Not if I'm ready. Not if I'm ready. There is a comfort in that that the world does not understand. And so we need to understand. God warned us about the brevity of life. And don't get complacent. Don't think that you have all the time and you're going to have time to do everything you want to do. And let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, I know by experience that not only the old die, the young die too. And we just need to be ready. We're going to Lexington Friday. Me and Rita, we're going to Lexington on Friday. And a funeral procession passed us. I knew who it was. It was that young mother and her two children that were murdered by her husband in Louisville. How could he do it? How could a father kill his own children? How do you prepare for that? You don't. You don't know. All of it reminds me that awful things can happen to us in this world. But if we're ready to meet God in the big picture, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Has God indeed said, do not lust after her beauty in your heart? Proverbs 6:25 says, do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids, for by means of a harlot a man is reduced to a crust of bread. And an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. But you know, I've heard this all my life. Well, it doesn't hurt to look. You know, it doesn't hurt to window shop. You know, you have a wife and you have a husband, and that's all well, but it's okay to look. It's okay to get involved. It's really not harmful. Today is an acceptable behavior. Do you know that over 50%, the last poll that I saw was 58 point something, of people who have been unfaithful in their marriages. That's over half. It's an acceptable behavior today. When I was born in the early 50s, that was an acceptable behavior. That was frowned upon. That was you would have like a scarlet letter on your back if you did something like that. Not today. Not today. God has indeed said, do not associate with one who flatters you with his lips. In Proverbs 20, verse 19, he who goes about as a tay-bill reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with one who flatters with his lips. You know what? I was told a long time ago, when everybody thinks you're a great guy, you need to maybe reevaluate what you're doing. And when somebody told me that the first time, I thought, well, that's a silly thing. But you know, the longer I thought about that, the more sense of that made. You know, when people are flattering you, there's a reason for that. What are they, you know, I guess I'm a skeptic. People start doing that, I start wondering what they want. You know, what are they trying to do? What are they trying to get me to do? So again, did God really mean that? Or is that something that really doesn't, God didn't really mean that? Here's the last one. Has God indeed said wine is a mocker? Wine is a mocker and strong drink is a brawler. And whoever is led astray by it is not wise. In 1 Peter chapter 4, in the first four verses, it condemns every level of intoxicating drink. Socially, reveling, partying, and drunkenness. It's all condemned as a way of the Gentiles. You know what's amazing to me? This is absolutely amazing to me. In our country, they outlawed cigarette commercials because it was bad influence on our children. But they leave the alcohol ones up. And that's okay. And they're on, and you know what's amazing? The NCAA tournament. You know, that's one of the biggest sporting events in our country. And, you know, that surrounds the colleges and the young people. And two of the sponsors of that NCAA commercial are the alcohol industry. Where is the mindset? You know, and now the alcohol industry, you know, they've caught on. And now you know what their commercials say? Drink responsibly. They didn't say don't drink. They didn't say stop drinking. Now, they ain't going to go that far. But they say, now drink responsibly. And they talk about the designated driver. I don't know how many of you have seen this Coors commercial that's out. They show the Rocky Mountains and show the snow and the water running through and got the beer there with the ice and they're sitting around. And at the bottom it says, wait until you're of age. We can wait. Well, then you have the old Milwaukee commercials that they're sitting there, out there fishing at night, got the lake out there, it looks really beautiful, sitting around the campfire, they're drinking, and they say, it doesn't get any better than this. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, how stupid do we think we are? Brethren, what good, you know what, it was a sad day in our community when they passed to bring alcohol in here to Harrisburg. And the thing that bothers me about that is how they did it. Because of the economy. You know, that's a high price to pay in order to boost your economy to bring alcohol. What about all the other things that alcohol brings with it? What about the drunk drivers? What about the underage drinking? What about the means of getting it more easily than they could in the past? What about the men and women who become alcoholics because now it's more accessible? Did they ever tell you about that? Did they ever talk about that? You know what? When they were debating that, Kim King was on the radio one day on her morning report, and she was talking about all the money that the bourbon industry brought into Kentucky last year. You know it's close to $1 billion in sales? And so I called Mrs. King up. I said, you know, I understand you're state representative, but you don't got to go on about it. You know, you can choose what you talk about. You know, and when they were having this bill, were you going to vote on it? I wanted to get on the radio. I said, can I come out and get an opposing view? Oh, we'll work you in. Did you hear me on the radio? No, you didn't hear me on the radio. They didn't want to hear my viewpoint because they wanted that passed, and it passed. Now, I'm not a prophet, but I want you to wait and see. The first fatality that we have where it kills a young man or a young woman, all those people who voted for it and used the economy as a reason, they will be silent as a mummy's tomb. And it will happen. Because that's the nature of the beast. That's what alcohol does. It changes you. I've watched too many people die. I've watched too many people destroy their life. And nobody's going to tell me that alcohol has ever done one good thing for our country, our nation, or our city. And in order to use it, in order that we might profit and be better profitable, that we might bring more profit to our community, I'd rather be poor. I'd rather lose the money than lose a life. To me, it's just not good wisdom. Did God know what he was talking about when he said that wine and alcohol can lead you in a place where you don't want to go? You know, sadly, some of you, even in this audience, know the destructive behavior and the battle that a person can have when alcohol gets a hold of them. It's destroyed lives, it destroyed marriages, and it has cut. Do you know the greatest killer on our highways is alcohol related? DUIs. Now, I read the other day where a man just got, you know, they do those things where they talk about people who've been arrested. He was arrested for his fifth DUI. Why is he still on the road? Brethren, in conclusion tonight, when God warns us about something, He means what He said. He's trying to help us. He's trying to protect us. And the devil is in the background whispering in your ear, that's really not what he meant. It won't hurt you. It won't harm you. Just dabble in it. Don't go overboard. Just do it. You know the word, you know a word that I have grown to dislike in my older life is the word moderation. Anything you do in moderation is okay. You know what? If you do sin in moderation, it's not good. Sin in any degree is bad because of what it cost and what it can cost you spiritually. Satan is very good at what he does. His desire is to lead you into sin, to destroy you spiritually, to get you away from God. And he's going to use every means to do it. And he can only be successful, and he can only deceive you if you don't pay attention to what God says. I suggest to you tonight that you reject the allurement of sin by listening to God instead of listening to him. Please take your psalm books out to the song that Brother Bill has selected as a means of encouragement. If you're here and you're not a Christian, we don't want to close this service without giving you an opportunity to obey the gospel. If you're here and you need to make some correction in your life, we're here to help you do that in any way we can to make your life right with God. And if we can help you, we bid you to come forward as together we stand as we sing.